It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a school program in West Bend designed to bring the outdoors into the classroom.
First, as the U.S. Supreme Court hangs at a 4-4 balance, Wisconsin has a number of high-profile cases making their way through the court system. President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to replace Justice Antonin Scalia is currently on hold in the U.S. Senate with no sign of a change anytime soon.
That impasse means that the U.S. Supreme Court may have only 8 justices for the rest of the year, which could lead to 4-4 ties, which would result in the lower court decision standing without setting a new precedent.
As the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports today, there are several Wisconsin cases that could at some point end up before this 8-justice U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us now to discuss the issues that could be ruled on is Ryan Owens. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an honorary fellow at the Institute for Legal Studies. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Sure, you bet.
Well, we've got this standoff over a 9th Supreme Court justice. How likely is it that we're going to see a lot of 4-4 deadlocks in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, we're likely to see some. I can tell you that the court really does not like 4-4 splits. Justices do whatever they can in many instances to avoid having to recuse themselves from cases precisely for this reason. A 4-4 split is, leaves the law unclear at times. And frankly, when justices, have to spend a lot of time on a case, to wind up just affirming by a tied vote seems like a lot of wasted time for them.
Is there much that this 8-member court can do to avoid cases? They can't just not take things, or can they? I don't know.
Sure. Well, there are a handful of things they can do. So on an ongoing basis, or maybe on a forward-looking basis, they can deny review to certain cases. Cases they otherwise might want to hear, maybe they just decide not to hear those at this particular point in time. But that doesn't really do anything for the cases that have already been granted. And I suspect those are the ones you're a little bit more interested in. For the cases that already have been granted, the court really has a couple of options, or a handful, I should say. One is, I suspect they could dismiss a case as improvidently granted, which is basically just say we shouldn't have granted review to this case. Another alternative would be to hold it over for re-argument and rehear the case next year when one would assume there's a 9th justice on the court. The other thing, of course, is the 4-4 split, and then you could see justices, I think, as we have seen over the last few weeks, trying to find compromise on narrower grounds and just dismiss cases accordingly.
But in general, if there's a 4-4 tie, whatever the next lower court that handled this case did, that just stands otherwise, right?
Well, that's correct. But let's be clear about it. So when the court affirms by an equally divided vote, it certainly affirms the lower court's decision, but it's not precedentially binding, which is to say it's not as though the court is sort of adopting the lower court's decision and setting that as national precedent. It just says we're not doing anything to that lower court decision. So to the extent that the 7th Circuit, for example, has rendered a number of decisions, the Supreme Court's 4-4 decision would leave those rulings intact. Those decisions by the 7th Circuit would continue to be binding within the 7th Circuit.
Talking to Ryan Owens from UW-Madison, political scientist there, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court and how 4-4 ties could affect us here in Wisconsin. And let's start bringing this home to Wisconsin now, Ryan. A bunch of cases that could end up before the Supreme Court. Voter ID. Now, a lot of challenges on this are dead, but there's one that was just kept alive, a certain subcase of voter ID. Do you see this maybe reaching the U.S. Supreme Court?
It's possible. I suspect that the Supreme Court won't want to decide this issue until it has a full court. The court is willing to tolerate some degree of conflict among the circuits before it steps in and grants review to cases. In fact, sometimes that's a good thing for the court because it can kind of see how different policy arguments will actually play out in fact. And in this instance, it's unclear to me whether the court would really want to go out on a limb and take this case. I think We just saw some other, election law type cases where the court tried to get rid of them sort of on narrow grounds. I suspect there's not much appetite to hear this case at this particular point in time.
And speaking of cases where different circuit courts might rule differently, abortion, the idea of admitting privileges for abortion providers, having to have admitting privileges to a hospital in a certain distance. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin, this one's moving through the courts. There was a high-profile case coming out of Texas, too. Do you see Wisconsin's ending up at the Supreme Court or another state's law affecting us here in Wisconsin if it goes to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think what you have to do here is pay attention to what the Supreme Court does in this Texas case. If you listen to oral arguments in that case, you heard a substantial amount of skepticism, particularly from the four liberal justices, about Texas's rationale for using admitting privileges. I suspect if anything happened with this, the court might just grant the Wisconsin petition and then hold it pending their decision in the Texas case. It's unclear where the court is headed on that one. If I was betting on it, I would bet that the court has some skepticism over these admitting privileges. The four liberal justices are pretty much in lockstep on that one. And I think it'll come down to how Kennedy and maybe Roberts, how they view those policies.
Then there's our redistricting law in the state, a challenge from people opposing Republican-led boundaries drawn in the state for voting districts, got a small win in court. This is one that the Supreme Court looks like it's weighed in the past. What do you make of this one and its future through the courts?
Yeah, I would be pretty surprised if the court takes this. At this point in time, it's not, of course, certain that they won't, But I suspect there, again, is not much appetite on this one. The decision, made by the lower courts here was a 3-0 panel decision to move forward with a trial, just not to have a decision on the briefs. There's really, I think, little reason for the court to step in and do anything at this point. We'll see the trial go on. I'm sure there will be evidence on both sides here about whether this is excessively partisan in terms of the redistricting capacity. I mean, the court is obviously willing to allow a substantial, I would say, amount of flexibility in these circumstances. They're comfortable with partisan lines being drawn, but at some point they have indicated that it could become too partisan. But even just recently in a challenge coming out of Texas, there was a challenge to how states apportioned their districts, and even there, the court seemed pretty reticent to get into anything too extensive here. And indeed, in that decision, the court has indicated that deviations up to 10% of the population will be appropriate. And basically, what that means is when states are redistricting, they can do a couple of funny things as long as the deviation, between like a population within the district and sort of the population one would expect isn't too extreme. So I just, reading the tea leaves from that decision, I suspect there's not much of a motivation by the court to get into this redistricting stuff right now.
As I understand it, this challenge in Wisconsin is kind of playing on something that Justice Kennedy had said, basically saying if we can find a way to measure a standard for that sort of deviation from what you'd expect, and it reached a certain threshold, then it becomes worrisome. Is that, even if this case doesn't make it to the Supreme Court, is that the wave of the future on redistricting?
Well, it could be. There are a lot of reasons for the court to get involved with these. There are a lot of reasons for the court not to get involved with these. And I think the court is always going to be somewhat skeptical, or I should say reticent, about getting involved with these things. And to the extent that challengers to redistricting can come up with a clear test, that might help the court feel more comfortable. This is, of course, not the first challenge. There have been plenty before, and the justices have really just been very nervous about getting involved.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet.
Ryan Owens is professor of political science at UW-Madison and an honorary fellow at the Institute for Legal Studies. He joined us to look at significant Wisconsin cases that could conceivably end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court before a ninth justice is appointed. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a new study shows the kind of music you like can provide a clue into your personality type.
First, there can be a lot of benefits to getting kids outdoors, from reduced stress levels to better physical health. But some recent research suggests that kids today are spending less and less time outside.
This is an especially tough issue for schools, as students need to be prepared for standardized tests. And that means there can be a lot of traditional learning in the classroom and less time outside.
A new program at the West Bend School District is looking to make sure kids do get some time outside. The district has partnered with the River Edge Nature Center to create a naturalist in residence program, combining outdoor learning with traditional education.
Megan Johnson is with us now. She's the naturalist in residence for the West Bend School District. Megan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the goal of this naturalist in residence program?
Yeah, so our vision as the naturalist in residence is to create a culture in the school district where students are outside learning on a regular basis. And River Edge is partnering with the West Bend School District, and this is the first one of its kind. And so the school district really gets to kind of decide the pathway for that, but really the main goal is to just get kids outside and learning.
You know, the school day can feel kind of short when you think about all the things that kids need to learn to be prepared to go on in life and in higher schooling as well. How do you make time to fit nature in?
Yeah, so we are trying to really integrate nature into the classroom. And so just like technology has been integrated into their classroom, we're trying to do that same approach with nature. And so taking lessons that they would already be learning in the classroom and then doing that same lesson outside. So we're trying to hit their standards and objectives that they would still need to meet for standardized testing, but doing it in a fun and different way outside.
What's an example of that?
Yeah, a good example is with second grade, we just did nature mobiles. And so normally they would do that lesson inside with paper and like paper clips and things. And instead we went outside, they got to collect some items and sticks, and then they built the nature mobiles outside with those natural items.
How do you think that changed the whole experience of doing a mobile for the kids?
They were super excited to get outside. It was done in the wintertime, so they obviously don't spend as much time outside in the winter, and so they were really excited to get outside of the classroom, and they had fun trying to identify the different items that they were picking up, and then they also really get that hands-on experience of the different weight of objects, like a rock versus a pine cone.
Now, I can see that in some cases people could make the, at least have a concern that, well, they're outside, are they really going to be focused on the job at hand if there's so much to distract them, and they might want to just play freeform outside. How does that work in terms of focus?
Yeah, you know, that was definitely a barrier that a lot of the teachers were worried about. And we found that if we front load it and really get the kids prepared that we're going outside, but we're going outside to learn. We're not going outside to have recess time. We're going out there to be scientists. The students really spend their time focused, and it's actually quite impressive. There will be kids outside on the playground having their recess, and the kids are completely focused on the task at hand. They aren't distracted by the other kids, and they're just excited to have more time outside learning.
So is this the first year of this program?
This is the first year of the program, yeah.
What is your sense of how it's going and how kids have reacted? Because I imagine this is a pretty big change in the culture of the school.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with the kids, and they seem to really be enjoying it. They love the new side to science, and something that they haven't really thought about before is science is something that can happen outside. And the teachers all seem to be really getting on board with the idea of getting their kids outside, and they're coming to me with ideas of, like, could we do this outside? Could we do this outside? And so we're starting to see that shift already in the first year of teachers really wanting to get their kids outside, and the kids are getting excited, which then helps motivate the teachers to get them outside as well.
Now, is this primarily a science program then?
It's not just science. It is also supposed to be for all other classes. So an example of that would be for fourth grade, we did a social studies class where they did map making, and they got to go outside and actually try to dimensionally make maps and look at that space. And then it was related to historical piece, like what would pioneers be looking for if they had came here and this was the first person ever to walk into West Bend.
And I've read you also did some work with prairies. What did you do there?
Yeah, so one of the things that has come across now with this is we're really trying to empower the admin and the teachers to go above and beyond. And so one of the administration at the middle school, Silverbrook Intermediate School actually, came forward and wanted to have a prairie planted in their kind of yard space at the school. And through the connections with River Edge, they were able to start moving that process forward. And hopefully next year we're going to have a prairie with a little bit of an outdoor teaching space right there at the school.
Have you heard from the kids about how this changes the focus of their education, or at least the way school feels to them?
A little bit, yeah. From conversations I've had, they see science as something that is tough and is book-based and can be kind of, to some of them, boring. And that's not how science should be. And they see that shift. They're excited when I come in the classroom that they get to go outside. They're excited about a new approach to a topic that they've already learned in the classroom. And sometimes they don't even realize they're learning until the end, when you start to recap and it all starts to click to them, like, oh, we just applied what we had learned in class.
We're talking with Megan Johnson right now. She's the naturalist in residence for the West Bend School District, and this position exists thanks to a partnership between the district and River Edge Nature Center, taking the classroom essentially outdoors, bringing some of those lessons into the great out of doors. And we're going to take a caller now. We've got Andy on the line from Onalaska. Andy, hi.
Hi, yeah, I was just interested in commenting on, very interested in your program. I actually am a big fan of like getting outside. I actually monitor how much time me and our family and our two kids are outside. One time on a program, I heard that average American spends less than 10% of their life outdoors, so I figured to beat that average 2.5%, it would be 2.5 hours every day to get outside. But as a teacher, I'm a Spanish teacher in Onalaska, and it is, even though I have a definite passion to get outside, I also feel like it's really hard with all the things that we are required to do, and especially in the high school, to get the kids outside. Even today, the kids really wanted to get outside. So I just wanted to comment on that, how even when you're passionate about it, it's so hard to get the kids out.
Right, Andy, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate that. Andy's done some math about what it would take to get people living their lives more outdoors. But he also says, you know, this is something he cares about. It's really hard for him to get outdoors. Does a position like yours, Megan, do you think make it easier?
I think it makes it somewhat easier for the teachers, because they can give me an idea and then I can create a lesson plan for them to help really hit those standards and objectives when we get outside. So it's still learning. And you know, for Andy, being a Spanish-speaking teacher, have your students go outside and start talking about things that are outside. You know, even if it's just taking the lesson outside and doing the exact same lesson you would have done inside that day outside, they're still outside. Even if they're not interacting with it, they still get to go outside, especially on a day like today where it's so beautiful outside.
Do you think that this is at all a hard sell to school administrators who might be the ones making the final decision on kids going outside more, Megan?
You know, the West Bend School District's admin has been super supportive, and they're really kind of pushing this, and it's awesome to have them behind it. And so I'm not really sure what it would be like to have an administration that would be a little bit more resistant.
At the end of the day, kids have to be responsible for learning things they need to advance to the next grade. Is there any evidence so far that this, you know, helps grades, or maybe in the other direction? What do we know about if it has an effect on that?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of research done, and that's actually why River Edge started to really kind of push this program, is because the research does show that students learn better outside. They learn, their grades will improve, their mental health, their physical health, and even their behavior will improve if they're learning outside.
Did you get any pushback from parents who are wondering, you know, are my kids still going to have time to learn if they're going outside all the time?
You know, we haven't seen any pushback yet from the parents, and one of the goals of the scientist resident program is to also really get that community engagement piece so that the parents do see that it is beneficial. And so hopefully we won't see any of that pushback.
And you mentioned winter, so that can be a tough time for anybody to get outside unless you're on skis or you're going sledding or something like that. Was it more challenging to do this in the winter?
It was more challenging. And, you know, one of the things that we quickly learned is that when you're working with small children, it takes a really long time to get dressed to go outside. Mm-hmm. And so we found that it's really best to do this right after recess. They're already dressed, they're already outside, and then you just meet them outside and do the activity while they're already dressed, and then you've taken and decreased that time that it would take to get prepared for the lesson. And that really does help a lot in the winter because, like you said, it's really hard to get kids outside, and for anybody, really, outside in the wintertime. So if we can meet them where they are, it makes it a lot easier.
And as you said, this is a new project that you've got going on. Do you have any lessons that you've learned from this year that you'll either take with you for the next year or the next school district, or things you might do differently?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is really pushing the behavior piece and really making sure that students are front-loaded with what we expect from them, and then also just having lessons created that are going to really engage the students in a different manner, but also really hitting those standards and objectives. The teachers really appreciate that. So just making sure that the lessons are 100% spot on to those objectives and standards.
Do you see this program becoming a wider thing, maybe catching on other parts of the state?
Yeah, I would love to see it catching on in other parts. And River Edge is actually in conversations with Cedarburg School District, which is another local school district, to start a scientist in residence or naturalist in residence there next year.
Well, Megan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Megan Johnson, the naturalist in residence for the West Bend School District. And she joined us there to talk about a new effort to incorporate outdoor time into school curriculum.
Coming up after the news, whether you like punk music or more mellow or soulful styles, musical genres can say a lot about your personality. We'll find out why and then ask for some of your musical input. By the way, join us tomorrow night at 8 for NPR special election coverage of the New York primary that'll stream online at WPR.org. It's live election coverage tomorrow night at 8 at WPR.org. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, researchers just confirmed that Zika virus can cause serious birth defects like microcephaly. We'll talk to an infectious disease expert from Wisconsin about the threat of Zika in the Midwest.
First, when you feel the need to listen to some music, what do you chase? What do you listen to? Do you turn to something like this?
Or maybe you're interested in something a little more mellow, like this.
Come away with me in the night.
Those are the Sex Pistols and Norah Jones, respectively, on very different ends of the music spectrum. The Sex Pistols, as you heard, loud, driving, harsh. Norah Jones, more reflective and emotional.
According to new research out of the University of Cambridge, whether you like one genre of music over the other can say a lot about your personality. Namely, some people who tend to be more empathetic, like slow, more melancholy music, and more logical people tend to skew in the opposite direction.
Joining us now to talk about this research is David Greenberg. He's a music psychologist who's doing this research at the University of Cambridge and the City University of New York. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what led you to tackle this issue of our musical preferences and our empathy or lack of same?
Well, I had noticed a lot of links between music and personality when I started playing music and playing the saxophone, and I thought that a similar trend would be able to emerge when people are listening to music, and that people may be listening to music as a way of reflecting. And we looked at two key personality traits called empathy and systemizing, and also people who have a balance of the two, and saw how that may influence the type of music that they listen to.
Before we pursue that, you play saxophone, I play saxophone. Obviously, there's something excellent about our brains, right?
Of course.
All right, well, let's talk about empathy and then the systematizers. How did you try to figure out who likes, who prefers what styles of music? How did you actually try to put this into practice?
So this has been a long-standing theory. It's called the empathy systemizing theory that was developed by a professor at Cambridge named Simon Baron Cohen. And essentially what he found was that you can classify up to 95% of individuals into three groups, either empathizers who have an interest in emotions, systemizers who have more of an interest in systems and patterns, and then you have individuals who are balanced, who have an equal levels of the two. And so what we did was we had over 4,000 people listened to about 50 different musical excerpts. These excerpts were representative of 26 genres and subgenres, and they just listened to each one and indicated how much they liked each piece of music. And in addition to that, they filled out standardized metrics of empathy and systemizing. And what we were able to do with all that information was be able to link people who were, they're called type E empathizers, who scored high on empathizing and saw that their musical preferences were largely for mellow styles of music, music that also had expressions of sadness, and also music that had emotional depth. On the other hand, what we found was that systemizers, who have this greater drive for patterns, preferred music that was more intense, had more positive emotions, such as joyfulness. But also what was interesting was that we found that not only do they like intensity in music, so genres from heavy metal and punk, but they also were preferring music with something called intellectual complexity, and that's often found in avant-garde genres, such as avant-garde classical music.
Interesting. So there really was a significant group between these two groups, the empathizers and the systematizers.
Right, exactly. So, in fact, when you look at it, kind of when we mapped it out, and in the article that we published, the empathizers and the systemizers, their scores were completely flipped. So empathizers preferred mellow music, music with negative emotions, and then emotional depth, but then systemizers were completely flipped. The opposite, they were preferring music that was more intense, positive emotions, and intellectual depth. Now, what's interesting, too, is that when you have individuals who score relatively equal on the empathy and systemizing measures, they're classified as being balanced. And what we found is that their preferences for music are much more broad in general, so they can like music that's on the more intense spectrum as well as music on a more mellow spectrum.
Well, I'm wondering if you can name names here. For the empathizers, what were some of the tracks that you played that they responded positively to?
So we had found Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah was one excerpt that is very strongly linked to empathizers. Norah Jones' Come Away With Me. So music that kind of expresses this sadness and also is quite mellow and has this emotional quality to it. Systemizers, on the other hand, preferred music. I believe the group's Five Finger Death Plunge, or it's much more intense. So heavy metal and punk, you could think of Metallica or Rage Against the Machine.
We're talking to David Greenberg, a researcher looking at the links between whether we're empathic or systematic in our thinking and the kinds of music we prefer. So I wonder, David, if there's a corollary here, if our personalities, if our brain's approach to the world determines what kind of music we like, can we affect the way our brain approaches the world by listening to certain types of music? Does it work in reverse?
In reverse, that's a really interesting question and something that we're beginning to look at now, which is we're asking participants to listen to certain music, and we're seeing how that may change their attitudes and the way that they're viewing themselves. So if they listen to, let's say, Happy by Pharrell Williams, will they become more energized and more joyful and energetic? Will they become more extroverted? Same thing if you play a certain type of piece of music, will someone become more empathic or will they become more systematic in their thinking? And this is something that we're really trying to address in future research. But the difficulty with this is that the best way to do it is to use something called a longitudinal technique and to trace an individual from when they're, say, quite young and then map what types of music they're listening to and how that might impact their development of personality. But that takes years and years and a lot of research grants.
Well, and this is a very early stage to be thinking maybe about this kind of question, but are there specific people who we might say they're particularly low in empathy? Maybe if we can find a correlation here, if we can see if this works, maybe music therapy would really benefit them.
Right. So one of the populations that we're looking at is individuals, both children and adults, who are diagnosed with autism. Now, individuals with autism, it's important to state that there's two types of empathy, because the popular notion that's expressed in the mass media is that people with autism don't have empathy, and that's not true. There's two different types of components of empathy. There's something called more of an emotional or affective component. This is how you respond to someone's emotions and respond to somebody else. And then there's cognitive empathy. And cognitive empathy is being able to understand someone else's intentions and to predict how someone's going to react. And this is the thing that individuals on the autism spectrum have difficulty with. And this leads to difficulty reading social cues and understanding social situations. So although this emotional and affective empathy is intact, this cognitive empathy is there's a deficit there. So one of the things that we might try to do in the future is to see how music might be able to be used to increase this cognitive component in empathy in people with autism, so that perhaps we can help them to better understand different social situations.
Now, music is such a almost universal for us as people. It's all around us. Is this just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to researching the interaction between music and personality and brain function?
It is, and there's many questions that remain to be answered. And like you mentioned, it's universal. There's not a single culture human culture that we know of that has ever existed that has not had music. And we're looking now at different trends cross-culturally, using upwards to 30, 40 different cultures of how music is being listened to, how it's used, seeing if this link between personality and preferences can be replicated in different types of cultures. And it is just the tip of the iceberg. And as you mentioned, it's quite universal and has been around since antiquity. And even the link between personality and music has been around for a long time. Pythagoras used to prescribe different modes and musical scales to people that differed based on their ailments or their personality characteristics. In Sufism, it's also believed that it's described a bit differently, but that everyone has a certain vibration and that they select music that's attuned to their vibration. So this is an idea that's been around for quite a while. And now with the advance of technology, we're really able to test it scientifically.
David, before I let you go, I got to say, I haven't taken your quizzes yet. I'm definitely on the systematizer side of things, and I definitely match the musical preferences. Where are you? What music are you listening to these days?
So that's quite interesting. If people are interested, and if you're interested, you could go to a website. It's called www.musicaluniverse.org, and this is a website that we set up where people can go take these tests on personality and musical preferences, and then they find their scores instantly. For me, recently, I've been listening to John Coltrane. That's a favorite of mine, and I've been listening to him over the past few days.
Emotional and systematic. I think people could go either way. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
David Greenberg is a music psychologist who's doing research into personality and musical preferences at the University of Cambridge and the City University of New York.
And we want to hear from you. Do you see yourself as more empathetic or more systemic? And what is your favorite song? Does your musical taste say something about who you are, do you think? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can let us know what your favorite song is and how it makes you feel on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we just wrapped up a conversation about a new study that shows your musical preferences can show whether your personality is more empathetic or more logical.
And now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're more alive when you listen to punk or hard rock or prog rock? Or would you rather kick your feet up with something more, I don't know, soulful? Something mellow, something emotional? What does your musical taste say about who you are? And do you have music that matches particular moods or that tries to get you into or out of particular moods? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave us your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And to kick us off, we just talked to researcher David Greenberg. He identifies as more logical and has been digging John Coltrane of late. Here's Coltrane's Crescent.
All right, well, now let's hear what you have to say. We'll go to Kay next in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi. Well, I don't exactly fit. I know I'm strong in empathy, But I like, I like all kinds of music. I like country western. I like some jazz. I like Gregorian chant. You know, I could listen to an alternative. My sister, on the other hand, likes to listen to 60s and 70s music. And if I listen to that too much, I get depressed. I start thinking about boyfriends where we used to break up, you know.
Oh, so you have you have reverse nostalgia, Kay.
Yeah, and so when we ride in the car together, when she's driving, she listens to the oldies but goodies, and when I'm driving, I listen to talk radio. So,
well, that's us. You're listening to us.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So.
Well, thanks a lot, Kay. So interesting mood and music matches. I was thinking about, too, with the John Coltrane, that's you could go either way on this. You could let it wash over you, and that's like the emotional listening, I think. Or with any kind of jazz, you can like really be in there and piecing it apart and breaking it down. I could see people on either side of the equation.
Absolutely, especially John Coltrane.
Yeah.
He almost, you know, he almost talks through his saxophone. Uh-huh. He's amazing. So I can see it appealing to both halves of the audience there. And let's go to Gary in Eagle River now. Gary, hi.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I fall right in line with that last statement that I consider myself more empathetic, but I like to rock mightily too occasionally. So I just picked up an old Springsteen album this week on National Record Store Day.
Oh, nice.
And I'm looking forward to not the slow melancholy, but the rockin' tune. So
which song, Gary?
Let's see, probably either Rosalita or the New York Serenade.
Ah, nice picks. Well, Gary, yeah, I think a lot of people are feeling just like you on that.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about how music fits our personality and how it can match our mood or even change our mood. You can let us know your favorites and what you think it says about you. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to one of my favorites a little bit now, a little clip from Queens of the Stone Age here. And I'll say, and I mentioned to our researcher there earlier, I'm really far on this one side of the equation. I like the rocking music. I don't like mellower, more emotional stuff. And I've been described in personality by some people as robotic. So I really do match. And I think that's a slight exaggeration.
I don't know.
But I think I fit. No, I mean, yeah, I'm exaggerating
a little.
You do
like to, you tear up. A
right.
Fair amount. It's your emotional.
When my robot fluid leaks. Yeah. No. But no, I think I definitely match this research, one of those extreme ends, more than I think a lot of people would.
Let's take another caller here at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we're going to go to Jeannie in Salem. Jeannie, hi.
Hi. I'm an avid WPR listener, but when I need a break, I listen to Vocal Chaos. It's a men's a cappella group out of Chicago, and there's something about that harmony that's just very, very soothing.
Yeah, I love really tight vocal harmonies, too. I feel that. Do you see that as being more empathetic for you or sort of more logical? Does your brain enjoy sort of unpacking what that music is doing?
Yeah, logical, I think.
Logical.
I want to listen to every part. I want to cue into which one, you know, focuses more now. And then I'm always listening for the next voice to come in. So, yeah, I think it's logical. But somehow I find it relaxing. Not stimulating.
Oh, great.
I don't know that fits, but
it's a little bit of everything. I don't know how to explain that for Jeannie. I don't know, Rob. Well, do you have any insight?
I feel that too. I mean, because when I'm listening to music, I feel like I'm picking. Oh, there's the bass, and here's this interesting thing the drums are doing, and ooh, what a cool chord progression. And honestly, there are times where I wish I could just. And sometimes I can either, but sometimes I wish I could just let the whole thing wash over me without dissecting it. So I want to move myself into that other camp. And I could see with an a cappella group like that, too. You just want to get that whole picture. That'd be a lot of fun.
Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for that call. And our producer, Halima Shah, says she's more empathetic and is a big fan of Amy Winehouse and her song Tears Dry on Their Own.
All I can ever be to you is a darkness that we know and this regret I've got accustomed to. Once was the ride when we were at our height.
And there's one on the more
empathetic
side,
yeah,
from one of our producers, Halima Shah. And I think I probably fall somewhere on that spectrum. But yet I love John Coltrane, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's...
I'm a hybrid.
The more I look at this, the harder it is to figure out. I think the research is finding that some people, right, like I think like me, are at the extremes of more empathetic or more systematic in the way they listen to music. I feel like a lot of people, though, are in the middle and are going to have a hard time categorizing like this. Weird from Eric, couldn't stay on the line, says Eric's more into... The rational and logical side of life, but Eric says he has a wide range of musical interests. Mozart and straight up rock and roll are the best. So that's a good good diversity in his musical taste.
Definitely.
There. Thanks, Eric.
And we're going to go to a caller now. We've got Richard with us next from Milwaukee. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, glad to hear it.
Where do you come down?
I like music, a lot of different kinds of music. I like older music, like Bob Wills and Woody Guthrie, and some of the old African-American folk singers, Louis Armstrong.
Sounds like maybe you're coming down more on the more empathetic side. You agree?
Yeah, it gives me hope. It gives me faith.
Yeah, I think that's something music can do.
They were encouraging us to do better, to care about life, to celebrate life, but to pitch in, to help, to work.
Sounds like, Richard, you're looking for some inspiration there from your music, something that's sort of the more touchy-feely side, I guess, of music.
I think so, and that's interesting, too. This is something I don't think our guest researcher looked at, but, like, the impact of the lyrics themselves and, you know, the vocals and the actual message and content. Because, again, on that sympathetic or the systematic side that I am, I very rarely know the words to songs. That's like one of the last things I discover. I try to convey a song to my wife, and I'll sing the bass line. She's like, "What? What are the words?" And I don't know. So maybe that's another thing. But again, that wasn't in the research. Thanks a lot, Richard. Interesting.
Well, our producer Matt Olson said he's more on the logical side, more like you, Rob, when it comes to his musical personality and his personality. He's a fan of Queen. Here's "Don't Stop Me Now."
Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
And Queen, I'm gonna say that's something for both sides, because you've got like really virtuoso music and production and guitar work, and then this almost operatic emotional stylings of Freddie Mercury and the lead singer. So I think that's something, and that's probably why Queen is so darn popular even all these years later.
Right,
they had it all.
The perfect blend. I think I would fall down on that perfect middle too, but I'm gonna have to do some real deep soul searching on this musical question thing, because I think I'm a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it's interesting food for thought. I again don't think most people are that far on the extremes one side or the other. However, still time for you to share your thoughts. Just tell us about your favorite music, the music you use to match a particular mood or to change your mood. Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. I think we've got some links to the research and the quiz they have there. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. A Wisconsin duck is at the cutting edge of high technology. Not, by the way, the amphibious vehicles you can ride up in the Dells there. No, an actual duck.
WBAY-TV in Green Bay has been following the story of Philip the duck. He lost his legs due to frostbite, and he was taken in by a woman from Pickett, Wisconsin. And she heard about a 3D printing project at a local school. That's a printer, by the way, that can print solid objects out of plastic or other materials. And she got in touch with the school to see if they could print Philip a new set of legs.
So class project ensued. After some trial and error, about 6 weeks worth of trial and error, the teacher and his students successfully printed a pair of legs that could be fitted onto Philip the duck. And after some trial and error of his own, Philip learned to walk, or I guess waddle on his brand new 3D printed legs.
And some more time after that passes, Philip is going to be moved to his new home, a sanctuary in Cedarburg.
And you can see Philip the duck and his 3D printed legs waddling around. They show kind of the learning process there. We've got a link to that over on the Central Time Facebook page. I watched this. Did you get a chance to
look?
It's
kind of inspiring, isn't it? That Philip has got new legs, a new lease on life, and he's learned to waddle again.
Good luck. And I think, swimming, on water, as ducks, you know, do.
It's
going to be the next step. He's going to be able to use these things as paddles, hopefully. So check it out, Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.